each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good afternoon and welcome to Winds of Change. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and it is my privilege to be sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. It is nice to be back with you. I was not here, as our faithful listeners know, last Monday because one of my children did not get the flu shot and got the flu, and so wound up in the emergency room. Note to the wise, always get the flu shot because it makes a difference, and which we learned the hard way at our house, but she is on the mend and back at school today, so I am back here with you, and I am joined today in studio by Clark Forsyth, who is the senior counsel at Americans United for Life, author of the book Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe versus Wade, and an expert on abortion law and policy. Clark Forsyth, welcome.
Thanks, Mary.
Thanks for being with us. You were traveling last week as well, too.
I was. Glad things are got back with
yes,
all the weather and
right
safe.
With all the you were on the East Coast, I believe.
On the East Coast,
yes, very good.
Coming back to the cold.
Well, there's lots going on that is keeping any lawyer who works on the pro-life issue very, very busy, and social media very busy with this as well. But primarily dealing with this new law that was passed and signed by Governor Cuomo in the state of New York, that dramatically sort of expands their abortion statutes in ways that I think most people didn't realize was even possible under the Constitution of this country and under the court's current abortion jurisprudence. And if you're a person who is on social media, are you on Twitter, Clark? I know you're on Facebook, but
from time to time.
Yes, Twitter is one of those things where you dip your toe in the pool and then pull it right back out. And after you, it's really, particularly when it involves the abortion issue, I got into it a little bit with, I feel I have earned a special place somewhere, hopefully in heaven, because I got challenged when I tweeted something about the New York abortion law by Leah Torres. The abortion provider Leah Torres came right back at me, and she is the one who had posted a tweet about how fetuses can't scream, and when she does abortions, she severs the vocal cords first. So I had the great privilege of being directly challenged by Leah Torres, who then tagged a bunch of doctor friends because I had the audacity to say that third trimester abortions weren't medically necessary, and that was her studied medical opinion. And I said, gosh, you know, when you were consulting on this New York bill, Dr. Torres, did you speak to any experts in maternal fetal medicine? And she claimed that every expert in maternal fetal medicine she spoke to said that third trimester abortions were safer and medically necessary in some cases.
So. Well, as you know, medically necessary means whatever the abortionist wants it to mean. Mm-hmm. Medically necessary is a kind of a weasel word in abortion law. And it means that if a doctor says, yep, this is necessary,
right,
it's medically necessary, well, because the doctor said it.
The medical expert said
necessary.
Right. And so, let's kind of start there with maybe for people who aren't as familiar as you and I would be with sort of how the court defines medical necessity and health when it's talking about abortion. Because when New York's law or Illinois' law or whatever, when there is a health exception for an abortion law. So, for example, third trimester abortions or post-viability abortions, I guess we should call them now, are banned except for the health of the mother. Clark, can you explain to our listeners what that means in terms of how the Supreme Court would look at health?
Well, health means something very special in abortion law. It was defined by the Supreme Court in 1973 in the companion case to Roe versus Wade called Doe versus Bolton, the case from Georgia. And in Roe versus Wade, they said the states can't prevent post-viability abortions after the child's viable if it's necessary for, quote, health, unquote. And then in Doe versus Bolton, they defined health as all factors, economic,
physical,
familial,
psychological, familial, the woman's age.
And the woman's age.
Ending with relevant to the well-being of the patient.
Yes.
Right.
So any emotional reason, any such as anxiety, is a health reason in abortion law.
Correct. Or a reason like I'm 19 and I'm too young.
So it's not just a health exception, but whenever you hear a proponent of abortion say this is necessary for health or we want to protect women's health,
that's what they mean. Right. Health can mean anything. And a lot of people, I think, you know, people who are really trying to look at this issue and what they believe is sort of a fair and balanced way. People who are, you know, have a good will think health and they think, oh, my goodness, a woman will die or sure her one of her, you know, major organs will be irreparably damaged if she doesn't have this abortion. But that's not what the law means by health.
That's not what the word means.
Common
in
sense
abortion
means
law.
That. Right. Exactly. Mm. So, OK, well, so having laid that groundwork, because this was sort of one of the interesting things that came to the forefront. It really gave, I think, the pro-life community, particularly the pro-life legal community, an opportunity to talk about how extreme our abortion law really is here in this country. So what the court said was that states could restrict, or they said even prohibit, abortions after viability, but not if the woman's health was at stake. And health, of course, is defined to mean basically anything. It's an exception so big you could drive a truck through it. And so people were really shocked that New York's law now allowed for third trimester abortions. And what changed in terms of the New York statute? Why did advocates for that law, Clark, claim it had to be changed first off? And then what exactly did the law adjust in as opposed to New York's previous law? Because New York was one of the first states to have legal abortion. I mean, well before Roe, 6 or 7 years before Roe, New York had already opened up its abortion statutes.
1970.
Yeah.
And that was passed by the New York legislature, which basically legalized abortion to 24 weeks for virtually any reason, left a ostensible 24-week limit in the 1970 law. Coincidentally, that was repealed by the legislature a year later as too broad. And
okay.
Governor Rockefeller vetoed the repeal, leaving the broad law in effect for 48 years.
Interesting.
And Governor Cuomo has wanted to expand abortion in New York to burnish his presidential credentials within the Democratic Party for 5 to 6 years. So he's been fighting for this abortion expansion bill for several years. It repeals the 24-week limit. It allows non-doctors to do abortions, and rescinds other health and safety regulations. But just allowing non-physicians to do abortions, or even more horribly, non-physicians to do late-term abortions, is just astonishing.
Yeah, and what's the rationale behind allowing non-physicians to perform abortions?
Pragmatic access.
Okay. So just to make to expand access so that anyone can get an abortion for. I mean, isn't that what Roe was ostensibly about, was because women were going to back alley, you know, people who may or may not have had medical degrees to get abortions? Wasn't that like the whole point, so that they would be done safely by doctors?
That was one of the statements in Roe.
Right, that's
and
what
then,
I recall.
And then in subsequent cases, actually, the court has adhered to that. With the statement that, well, the states can continue to require that only physicians can do abortions. The states, if they want, can insist that only physicians. But that also means the states can repeal that mm-hmm. and allow non-physicians.
Okay, so that's fully permittable. Roe permits non-physicians to
Well, Roe permits the states to repeal that if they want.
If they want to.
And there are probably something like 12 states now that allow non-physicians to do some abortions.
Right.
Might be early abortions, might be aspiration abortions, might be RU46 abortions.
Right.
But approximately 12 states allow that now. And approximately 38 to 39 continue to insist on only physicians.
Okay. And so, okay, so you have sort of this veneer over all of Governor Cuomo's statements and what you saw in the New York General Assembly, that this was all ostensibly about women's well-being and women's health. But you and I are familiar with this Bartlett study on maternal mortality that was done
2004,
15 years ago. Let's talk a little bit about that because, you know, that's such a respected study. And talk a little bit about those findings, Clark.
Well, as you said, it is a respected study. It's cited across the board by people of different medical perspectives as being a reliable, credible study. It's cited for a number of different points of medicine. But what Bartlett found was that maternal mortality increases in the second trimester, and after 20 weeks of pregnancy, the maternal mortality rate from abortion goes through the roof.
Right.
Specifically, it more than doubles the rate of maternal mortality after 20 weeks. So every woman should be warned of that.
Right.
She can't be fully informed unless she knows that the rate
her
of maternal
risk,
mortality
right.
more than doubles after 20 weeks.
Right. And these are not self-induced abortions. What they mean by that is abortions done in abortion clinics by abortion providers, the maternal mortality doubles after 20 weeks. And, you know, and that this is one of the points of incredible, as I mentioned, you know, the Twitter cesspool, incredible, you know, points of misinformation being spread by Dr. Leah Torres, who was the one who challenged me, saying it is safer in some cases to have an abortion, but she couldn't cite that particular case. I said, you know, did your maternal fetal medicine expert friends that you claim supported this bill, did they cite studies? And she goes, no, they didn't send any studies to me. You know, it was very, very interesting, a lot of dodging going on, and I was really trying to engage her intellectually, but she simply wasn't interested in it. But are there any particular cases that you saw cited in the lead up to passing and then this bill ultimately being signed that were in a particular way signed signified as being necessitating abortion?
No, I don't.
Yeah,
I can't recall
think of
anything
any.
In the legislative history.
Right.
I don't think they think they need any evidence
right.
or any data or any cases. And incidents or cases might not be representative of any group of women.
Right.
Again, it was all headlined under the cloak of quote unquote health.
Right. And
access.
Yeah. So, but I think, you know, so there's the point though, Clark. I think it's really more about access, isn't it? It's more about access. It's more about abortion clinics not needing, you know, being able to kind of skirt around some of the regulations that they feel tie their hands when women are coming to them. It's about being able to, frankly, operate a business in the way they feel is most cost efficient to their business.
And again, being able to do as many abortions as possible during the course of any week for
right.
women who want it.
Right. Well, on that unhappy note, we're going to take a short break, Clark. When we come back, let's get more into the specifics of the New York law. I'm taking your questions, listeners on Facebook or on Twitter, if you have a question for Clark Forsythe about the New York abortion law and what might it portend for the state of Illinois. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Listener Supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. Don't go away.
Every parent has a dream of giving their children a great education and great faith. St. Stanislaus Kostka School, a nationally acclaimed Catholic leadership school, has made the dream easier for you to achieve. Here, leadership principles and lessons are an integral part of your child's coursework and school culture. Your child will study foreign languages, such as Mandarin, conduct experiments in real science labs, attend Eucharistic adoration, and more. Don't worry about affording a private education. St. Stanislaus Kostka School offers full tuition scholarships for kindergarten through eighth grade. Send your child to St. Stanislaus Kostka School, located just minutes from downtown Chicago. Dreams can come true, but you need to call today, 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. 773-278-4560.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Father Loya invites you to see the new Tabor Life website. That's taborlife.org. When you land on the homepage, you can see how Tabor Life can help improve your marriage, your life, and how to see the beauty of God's created order in your personal life. On taborlife.org, you can book Father Loya to speak to your organization about the key elements of leadership, relationships, and sexuality, as well as speak on cultural, social, and political issues. As a renowned artist, Father Loya can speak about how art, liturgy, and prayer fit together. On taborlife.org, you can see the many ways of how you can communicate with us. And as you look to the lower right-hand corner of the page, click on the messenger icon for live chat. And finally, Tabor Life Institute is a 501(c) charitable organization that earnestly needs your support. Click on the support link at the top of the page and donate. After all, Tabor Life is powered by you.
Our law.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750. Thank you for tuning in to be with us this afternoon and learn about this really incredibly important topic. I am so grateful to be joined today by Clark Forsythe, who is the author of Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade, an attorney with Americans United for Life. He is the senior counsel there, certainly considered one of the nation's leading experts on abortion law and policy, not just as it relates to Roe and Doe, the federal cases, but specifically, Clark does a lot of work in the varying states across the country where abortion is legal, working on helping state legislators and legislatures to pass reasonable restrictions on abortion that were granted to the states by this Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision. So Clark, you have traveled. You've probably been in every state in the country, I would guess, at this point in your career.
Except for Idaho and Montana.
Okay, but there's still time.
And I know. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, so we're... because one of the most shocking things about what's happened in New York, the case in Virginia, which came shortly thereafterwards, then New Hampshire,
Rhode Island,
and New Mexico,
yes,
all looking at very similar laws, passing very similar laws to the New York law, which was really rather breathtaking. And it's sort of not in just that it was extreme, because abortion really has been legal for all 9 months for any reason since 1973, but in the kind of boldness of it and the absolute, you know, straightforward way in which you find those supporting these laws talking about them. Go ahead.
And some of these laws are more extreme than Roe in the sense that they repeal limits that the Supreme Court has allowed.
Okay, for example, let's talk about that for a bit.
Such as the states can require that only physicians do abortions.
Right.
Which would tend to protect maternal health.
Right.
Some of these, New York, repeals that requirement, and other states like Illinois seem to be moving in a direction that they want to repeal physician-only requirement.
Right.
So these are alarming, not only because they expand the killing of children, but they lower the standard of care for women.
For women, which was supposed to be, a primary concern.
Supposedly.
Of abortion legislation, you know, when it was first introduced, of course, in Texas and the Supreme Court cases that then did away with all of the, you know, in most cases, very common sense restrictions on abortion from state to state, which really did protect, you know, the interests of women. And, you know, there's so many studies now, objective, peer-reviewed scientific studies that talk in a very straightforward way about the risks to maternal mortality from post-viability abortions. Let's talk a little bit about that. I know you are quite familiar with the Bartlett study. If Clark, if listeners wanted to look up that study on their own, where do they go to find that? Would you just Google Bartlett study or is it a...
Yeah, I think it's widely available.
Okay.
It's been used by...
where was it
many
done?
Well, it was published in 2004 by a leading medical journal.
Right.
And I think it's easily accessible. And if you put Bartlett abortion 2004, I'm
right,
sure
that'll
would,
come up. Okay. Yep. And so talk about what populations did the study look at, and tell me about the findings.
Well, it was generally looking at national data up until before 2004, but it was looking
in the United States only?
In the United States, yes. And it basically found that approximately 16 weeks, the maternal mortality rate is 29 women per 1,000. And after 20 weeks, it went to 76 per. Hmm. So it more than doubled after 20 weeks.
Hmm.
It shows clearly that after 20 weeks, the maternal mortality rate more than doubles. And so any political leader, any state rep, any governor who is supporting these late-term abortion bills, they should be asked, have you read the Bartlett study?
Yes.
Do you understand the increased rate of maternal mortality? And will every woman who's invited to have a late-term abortion be informed of this data as well?
Right. And you know, I'm just kind of thinking off the top of my head here, the what I hope will happen, and this is going to be kind of interesting because the plaintiffs bar, also known as the Personal Injury Lawyers, you know, Association, the plaintiffs bar, are, of course, always looking for these kinds of evidentiary findings, aren't they? Like, you know, the abortion provider knew or should have known that exponentially the rate of maternal mortality will go up from 20 weeks onward, but the patient was not given any of that information prior to making the quote-unquote abortion decision. And, you know, we had that tragic case of Tanya Reeves here in Chicago, who was having a late second trimester abortion at the Planned Parenthood here in Chicago. She was 23 weeks pregnant. She already had a toddler at home. Very beautiful, strikingly beautiful African-American woman, and essentially just bled to death. It was 7 hours, from what I understand, from the lawsuit that was filed, 7 hours before 911 was called, and then she wound up passing away at Northwestern's hospital. But, you know, it's really, it was interesting to me to see how little media coverage there was of her death.
So sad.
And, yeah, and Planned Parenthood's, you know, well, of course, it is the safest, one of the safest procedures women can have in the country, and this is a very rare occurrence. But, you know, it's interesting because of the way in which abortion information and health statistics are protected by the abortion industry. I mean, some states don't even have reporting requirements, do they?
Some don't, and some don't collect the record very much. In fact, Roe versus Wade, of course, issued by the Supreme Court in 1973, without any national system of abortion collection, reporting, analysis. There was no such national system, and none exists today. And that means that even the annual number of abortions is merely an estimate.
Right.
It's merely an estimate.
Right. And I know when I was, you know, kind of scrolling through Twitter and Facebook after the abortion decision, you know, after Cuomo signed the law in New York, I was astounded to see the number of people on the pro-choice side of the argument citing the CDC statistics, the Center for Disease Control statistics, which are notoriously underreported. I think it doesn't even include the entire state of California, which is has the most populous, one of the largest numbers of abortions.
California hasn't reported its data to the CDC for several years. I mean, 8 or under 10.
Yeah. And so that they were saying, well, the CDC says that there's only 10,000, you know, abortions after 20 weeks in the United States, which is notoriously low. I tend to rely on the Guttmacher numbers simply because Guttmacher is so closely associated. They're no longer formally affiliated with Planned Parenthood, but for many years was Planned Parenthood's research arm, the Guttmacher Institute. So at least they're getting the numbers from their own clinics there. And since Planned Parenthood provides the largest number of abortions in the country, you know, at least that's probably a little bit more accurate in terms of numbers. But we'll never really know because we have states that simply never report and aren't required to report.
And the CDC doesn't have a system in place to comprehensively collect and analyze.
Correct.
But your point about the Med-Mal system, the medical malpractice system in the U.S. is an excellent one because if there are not high standards in the law, if there are not preventive standards in each state, and if these are eliminated or never enacted in the first place, then all a woman has to rely upon is the medical malpractice system for a remedy if she is injured. And we know that the medical malpractice system will only be responsive, that attorneys will only take a case if there is some horrific injury or death mm-hmm. that promises a, you know, astronomical recovery.
Right.
So women who are injured short of astronomical injury
right.
Don't have a remedy.
Right.
If these preventive laws are taken away.
There have to be real damages, right?
So yeah,
there
has to substantial. Be.
A loss of your fertility or, significant, harm, bodily harm being done to you. Because a court's not going to allow that case to go forward if there's simply minimal injuries and it's not worth the attorney's time.
And so relying upon the medical malpractice system is no remedy for women.
No, it's not a remedy. It could be part of the picture, but it's not. It's certainly, we can't rely on that. And then, you know, frankly, when you look at the demographics of women who have abortions, many of them, you know, are not well-educated, well-connected people who would likely know how that all works, right? Mm. I think some women who might have brought suit fail to do so because they're not aware, for example, that, you know, the vast majority of plaintiffs' bar attorneys work on contingency. So, therefore, you don't have to pay. They'll say, oh, I should have sued that abortionist. I can't have any more children, but I never had the money to file a lawsuit. Well, you wouldn't have needed that, you know. And so I think you're dealing in some respects with a demographic that isn't aware of the tort system in the United States and how to bring suit and how lawyers normally, you know, work in that regard, but and how they're compensated. But Clark, I found the study, and listeners, this is a really important study, especially if you're an Illinois resident and you want to be well-versed and well-informed about this particular issue, as now we in Illinois, as is widely reported now, are going to be taking up a law even more extreme than New York's. The study is called Risk Factors for Legal-Induced Abortion-Related Mortality in the United States. Again, Risk Factors for Legal-Induced Abortion-Related Mortality in the United States. It's called the Bartlett Study because one of the authors is L.A. Bartlett, joined by C.J. Berg, H.B. Schulman, and S.B. Zane. And you can find it at www.ncbi.nih.gov. So it's a National Institutes of Health study. So it came from the government. So another very, very good source, kind of an unimpeachable source in many ways. And again, I'll just read to you for one line from the study. The risk of death for women undergoing an abortion increased exponentially by 38% for each additional week of gestation of the abortion procedure. So you have a government study saying the risk of death increased exponentially for women having abortions and goes up by 38% each week you go into the abortion. Let's talk about, again, some of these things. So first of all, let's kind of tackle this. It's sometimes safer for women to have abortions post 20 weeks, let's say, because that's generally kind of the time where we're looking at bans, right, that might actually be constitutionally feasible, right, post-20-week bans.
Well, there are 20-week bans in 21 states, but the statement you made, I think, requires us making a distinction between a woman in a late term who may need a early delivery versus an abortion, which is the direct killing of the child.
Right.
So there are neonatologists and who will say there are cases of preeclampsia in which a woman needs an early delivery.
Right.
She needs the pregnancy ended and the child delivered. But that's fundamentally different than an abortion, which means directly killing the child. Well, and that distinction needs to be carefully preserved.
Exactly. And this is where, you know, I find I've been able to make some headway, I think, with some groups and people I've spoken to because, you know, you have this, you know, first of all, there's the mother has to have the abortion or she's going to die. And you talk to maternal fetal medicine experts. So those are the doctors. It's a subspecialty of obstetrics and gynecology. They have years of additional training past their medical degree. They treat the sickest mothers with the sickest babies, okay? And to almost to a doctor, this is where what Dr. Leah Torres, the abortionist, said to me, I found it so puzzling, where she said that all the maternal fetal medicine experts that she had spoken to were in favor of these late-term abortion bills, where the testimony I have seen is exactly the opposite, where they'll say, no, so, as you say, Clark, sometimes you have to separate the mom and the baby early. Yes, absolutely. But killing the child is never necessary medically, first of all. And secondly, can actually lead to further complications for the mother. Dr. Anthony Levitino, who we both have had the privilege of meeting, former abortion provider, he worked for more than 10 years in kind of a high-risk clinic. He's both a JD and an MD, so he's a lawyer and a doctor. He's both degrees, so very well-versed on this, both legally and medically. And he said never once in the 10 years of treating the sickest moms with the sickest babies did I ever have to directly kill a child in order to separate him or her from the mother. Now, he said, did every single child that I delivered early make it? No. He said, but you know what? A lot of them did. A lot of them did. So that's the, you know, point A, that there are simply so many options now medically. And then people come back at you with, oh, well, you know, we live in a rural area and there's no doctor that could absolutely ever, you know, be able to treat. Again, not true. You're talking about usually in most cases a C-section, a fairly standard, you know, procedure. 38% of American women have C-sections every single day in the United States. It's a fairly standard way of treating preeclampsia or other, you know, conditions that may necessitate the early delivery of the child. And then, you know, you have the next one, the next argument that will be raised to you is this argument of the baby is going to die anyway. I simply couldn't put a woman through this. Now, I am a great, Clark, as you may know, advocate of perinatal hospice and palliative care. And the studies, like you cited the Bartlett study, there's additional studies, quite a few of them now at this point, that show that the outcomes for women, I mean, you can take the, you know, the child's outcome and separate that completely, but the outcomes for women are exponentially better if she chooses perinatal hospice over abortion. And in fact, there was one study I was reading that showed that 97.5% of the women who had lost a child but had gone through perinatal hospice and palliative care said if they were faced with another adverse prenatal diagnosis, they would choose perinatal hospice every time.
And how would you define perinatal hospice?
So, in the same way that you would define hospice for a person who's already born. So you have the same kind of so hospice is a care program, if you will. So a care plan for a child who you know is either going to be born dying or with a life limiting condition. So generally, in order for an adult person to go into hospice, you generally have to have a diagnosis to be admitted into a hospice program of life expectancy of less than 6 months. And so this more or less the same applies to children, either, you know, for anencephaly is kind of the you know, the term that's often, the condition that's often cited in these cases is absolutely you need to have an abortion. My child's going to be born without a head. I mean, some of the things I've seen people post on Twitter about, you know, and I keep coming back with, you know, these are, you may want to refer to them as monsters without heads or however, whatever dehumanizing, horrible term. But remember, that's somebody's child. That's someone's child who they love, who they wanted, you know, and to refer to them in such, you know, atrocious with such atrocious phraseology, it's just it's just horrible to me. But just as a mother, you would receive this adverse prenatal diagnosis. You would meet with a perinatal palliative care team who would explain to you the options that you will likely have when the baby is born. Now, I heard an excellent lecture by a neonatologist at Columbia University in New York. I'll see if I can find the link during the break, listeners, so I can share it with you, because it was a best use of 20 minutes I've spent in some time. And she runs the palliative care program at Columbia for neonates. And she says, my advice to the parents is always, first, here's what we think is going on. But let's wait. Her motto would be for her perinatal care is, let's follow the baby. Let's see what the baby tells us. We're going to follow the baby. And she cited, you know, one case where it looked as if it was a form of anencephaly. But when the baby was born, actually, he had a cyst on his brain. She said, which was very easily correctable. Now, we also had a heart valve issue that they were able also to correct at 9 months. She said, a very simple procedure. And he had Down syndrome. And then she showed pictures of him. He's 9 years old now. He's a very happy little boy with mm-hmm. Down syndrome. He's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, could be like one of those, you know, the new Gerber baby model is a little guy with Down syndrome. But she said, you know, basing now, for the most part, the prenatal diagnosis is accurate. But sometimes you really don't know till the baby's born, until there's a full assessment, what is actually going on with the child. So she said, you know, let's listen to the child. Let's see what the child tells us. And she had obtained the permission of a number of families that she worked with and told their stories. And, you know, it was beautiful. They had one family that had a birthday cake for the baby. You know, he lived about 6 hours. All the brothers and sisters held him. And she said, you know, sometimes, you know, she said, in my professional work, I'll hear people say, oh, it's cruel to do that, to tell the siblings. And she said, no, the siblings, you know, she showed one case and the little brothers were saying, oh, she's finally here. Our sister is finally here. Mm. And she didn't live through the day, but she said they did everything for her during that time that she had her. They had her, rather. And so the outcomes for women. So that's kind of what palliative care is, perinatal hospice is. And there's also a prenatal or postnatal palliative care. So this is the other argument you will hear, that these children are going to die gasping for breath. They're going to be in excruciating pain. How could you do that to your child? You know, I started out the hour by talking about, you know, that I missed last week because I had a daughter who wound up in the emergency room because she got influenza A. And I tell you, that's a horrible, you know, you have kids, Clark, I know you know this. Watching your child suffer is a horrible thing. I mean, it was, and my kid just had the flu and, you know, very high heart rate. But boy, that was, so I understand that sentiment. You don't want to see your child suffer. However, as you know, neonatologists will tell you, and pediatric anesthesiologist, there's really no pain that cannot be lessened or relieved with the same kind of palliative care you would use for an adult who was dying.
We certainly want to encourage women and couples to have access to perinatal hospice and to understand its availability.
Can you talk about legislation in that regard? Because it was AUL involved in, because I believe Nebraska passed a bill that would make
And Minnesota has a perinatal hospice kind of informed consent law, which requires that women and couples be informed about availability of perinatal hospice.
Right.
And it's not well known across the country what it is. And I'm so glad you're able to talk about it today, Mary, because more women and more couples need to know about it. Because doesn't the medical studies show that women have better psychological outcomes?
Well, that's what I meant. Yeah, when I was saying that the outcomes for women are better, far lower rates of depression, far lower rates of anxiety. And unlike, you know, when a woman is having an abortion, having a late-term termination or abortion, you know, she goes home from the hospital empty-handed. She, you know, may or may not have a memento of her child if the abortion provider gave her that. But perinatal hospice actually follows the family for the next year. So they stay with the family. There's additional counseling provided if they need it. And so it really is, it's a far more holistic way to approach the death of the child than this sort of abrupt ending of the child's life. And then, you know, you go back and attempt to, you know, assume the rest of your life. But again, far lower rates of depression, anxiety on all levels, on all psychological rankings, the women who chose perinatal hospice were exponentially better off than the women who terminated. So we are going to take our final break. Listeners, when we come back, we will wrap up our conversation with attorney Clark Forsythe, author of the book Abuse of Discretion. You can find that on Amazon, The Inside Story of Roe versus Wade. This is Mary Fiorito. I am sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Every parent has a dream of giving their children a great education and great faith. St. Stanislaus Kostka School, a nationally acclaimed Catholic leadership school, has made the dream easier for you to achieve. Here, leadership principles and lessons are an integral part of your child's coursework and school culture. Your child will study foreign languages, such as Mandarin, conduct experiments in real science labs, attend Eucharistic adoration, and more. Don't worry about affording a private education. St. Stanislaus Kostka School offers full tuition scholarships for kindergarten through eighth grade. Send your child to St. Stanislaus Kostka School, located just minutes from downtown Chicago. Dreams can come true, but you need to call today, 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. 773-278-4560.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. I am sitting in today for Father Anthony here, as I do most Mondays, here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And I've been joined this past hour by attorney and author Clark Forsyth. Clark is senior counsel at Americans United for Life. If you'd like to know more about them. And AUL is, along with National Right to Life, one of the oldest pro-life organizations in the country. Yes. Clark, is that true? Your oldest or second oldest, something like that?
Founded in 1971, yes.
Right, yeah. So AUL.org, very easy to remember, AUL.org. If you'd like to learn more about them, AUL is really considered the leading sort of pro-life legal nonprofit in areas of law and policy and state legislation, in addition to analysis of cases that are going on at the federal level. So we were just sort of wrapping up in that last segment, Clark, talking a little bit about perinatal hospice, and you and I share a mutual friend who went through this particular experience, and our friend Jeannie, I can say this because she's very public about her story, and in fact, she testified at the federal level when Congress was taking up the partial birth abortion legislation, and Jeannie was one of the people who testified against the procedure, partial birth abortion. She was expecting twins, and about midway through the pregnancy, was told that she had a boy and a girl and that the girl was not developing as expected. And so further testing and ultrasounds revealed that her daughter had a rare form. It wasn't anencephaly because she had her entire brain and brainstem, but the skull had never fused closed. So her brain was not protected, and therefore, birth would be probably a life-ending, if not completely life-limiting experience. Jeannie has a master's degree in public health. You know, she was telling me really the only option she was presented with, and it really wasn't presented as an option, it was kind of presented as a you really should do this sort of thing, was termination of the one child. And what was frightening for her was that her doctors kept insisting she was jeopardizing the life of the healthy twin if she didn't abort the sick twin, and which was an additional, anxiety-provoking experience on top of the already very devastating news that their daughter was likely not going to live. But she went to a local medical school and did research in the school library, and that's how she found out about perinatal hospice. She didn't know. She didn't even know that that was something that was possible. So she presented that to the doctors and essentially said, this is what I would like to do, and I would also like to speak to somebody about donating my daughter's organs, if that's possible, and had done additional research and found that, you know, that infant organs are in a tremendous shortage of all the organs, because any baby, I mean, just to kind of speak about it in a very frank way, babies that might possibly be organ donors to give that gift to another family are generally terminated before they can be born. And so she did some additional research and found out that her daughter's heart valves would be able to be used, perhaps a kidney, but they weren't really sure. Again, you know, as I talked about the neonatologist who said, we have to follow the baby. Let's see what the baby tells us. So her daughter was born. She lived about 6 hours. Each of her grandparents held her. One of the grandmas was Croatian, and she said, you need to know a little Croatian if you're going to be meeting your great-grandparents in heaven. I have to. So they sang to her. They held her. She was baptized and died in her father's arms very peacefully and just very kind of slipped away. And it was a very peaceful death and very sad and difficult for the family. But the most beautiful part, Clark, is the morning of the baby's, you know, memorial service, that little funeral that they had for her. They got home from church, and there was a letter from the Illinois Organ Donation Registry with the names of the two little girls that had lived because Mary Bernadette gave her heart valves to those two little girls. So, you know, was it sad? Yeah. Was it sad? Was it? But, you know, here's a little story from the, I'm not sure if you were there that day on Capitol Hill when Jeannie testified on the partial birth abortion bill, but there was another woman that Planned Parenthood had brought forward. And of course, she said, you know, her mother worked at Catholic Charities. They were a great Catholic family, and she had to have this abortion. She had to. There was no other way. So she testified, and then Jeannie testified and told her story, and this woman snapped. And she turned to Jeannie, and she started to scream, no one told me. No one told me I could do that. No one told me about organ donation. And this woman started sobbing, and it was awful. And then you had, like, the pro-life women trying to console this woman who had been brought forward by the abortion advocates because no one had told her. So I know that you're involved in legislation that would make that a requirement of doctors.
Well, that's why perinatal hospice needs to be widely known, and women need to know it so that they can choose a natural and nonviolent solution for ending for their child.
Right, and that might possibly give them the additional consolation of providing a gift to others. And not everyone's, you know, that's not required of anybody, you know, I would argue, but it certainly for a lot of families gives some meaning to what they've been through. Additional meaning, I shouldn't say some meaning, because obviously even if the baby's organs can't be used, you're going to derive peace and consolation from simply holding your child and being with your child. And again, the testimonies that I've heard from the families who have gone through perinatal hospice, it's an incredibly beautiful experience for so many of them. But so, Clark, in the time we have left, a lot of things we wanted to hit on. We talked a little bit about New York's law and the way in which it changed. Let's talk, another big legal story vis-a-vis abortion this week was the law coming out of Louisiana and the Supreme Court's failure to uphold that particular law. This is not a case that they had taken to hear formally, though.
That's right.
Can you walk through the non-lawyers?
Yes, this is at the early stages. So this case is going to end up in the Supreme Court, most likely. And so it wasn't a final decision by the Supreme Court. It was a procedural preliminary point. And the case is going to continue, and the case will be brought to the justices, and there will be an appeal in the case. And so the justices will sooner or later address this case on the merits. It involves a requirement that a physician who does abortions have admitting privileges at a local hospital within 30 miles so that if a woman suffers complications that she can be admitted to a hospital within 30 miles. So it's, again, keeping a high standard of care. We should be on the pro-life movement needs to be, must be on the side of women, because certainly Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry is not. And we show that by caring for women and making sure that there is a high standard of care. So this case will end up in the Supreme Court. And I had mixed feelings that, mixed thoughts, shall we say, that the court didn't allow the law at this stage to go into effect. I don't know all the facts or the record in the case. And so I'm willing to provide some benefit of the doubt pending the case's final decision outcome by the justices.
Right.
Hopefully they hear the case in the fall of 2019 or early 2020. But this, I think it's important to point out that this is one of perhaps a dozen or more cases that are heading to the Supreme Court. There's a couple of cases from Indiana, involving ultrasound-informed consent.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about those cases that the Supreme Court may or may not grant cert, which is kind of the fancy legal shorthand for granting certiorari, the Supreme Court's decision to take a case and hear it. Have they granted that in that Louisiana, Clark? No, they've not granted. They've not said either way whether they're actually going to take that.
In Louisiana, no.
Correct.
And same for the Indiana ultrasound case. The appeal was filed in the Supreme Court. The court will consider in coming months whether to hear the Indiana ultrasound-informed consent. And I think that's a very important case because the court has not yet considered whether ultrasound can be part of the informed consent process. But really, a woman can't be fully informed about an abortion unless she sees an ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a second case from Indiana, which is at the Supreme Court right now already, and that involves whether the state can require the humane disposition of fetal remains after an abortion, recognizing the humanity of the child,
mm-hmm.
and secondly, whether Indiana and other states can prohibit abortion based upon that are done for discriminatory purposes simply because of race, sex, or
so that's
disability.
That's the Down syndrome case.
Correct.
Correct.
It's broader than that.
I know it's
yes.
more broad than that. Yes. That's kind of, I think, how I've heard it referred to. So the fetal remains case and the abortion based on disability, is sex
they're
disability?
They're the same case. Yes.
Okay.
Two parts of the law.
Okay. And can you just walk us through, if you could briefly, do you know the fact pattern in the fetal remains case? Did this come out of the David DeLeiden investigation where they found that Planned Parenthood was actually selling the fetal remains?
Well, that has been background in a number of cases. So that has provided an evidentiary basis for a number of cases, including an additional one from Texas that is heading to the court as well. Because, as you know, there has been a criminal referral from a Senate committee and a House committee to the Department of Justice to investigate Planned Parenthood's possible violations of five federal laws mm-hmm. for those procedures. There was also a Medicaid funding case. You'll recall, Mary, that early in December, the Supreme Court refused to hear two Medicaid funding cases from Louisiana and Kansas.
Okay.
Declined to take up those cases.
Okay.
But that issue is coming back to the Supreme Court in a Texas case called Planned Parenthood versus Smith.
Okay.
Meaning
the states had moved to block Medicaid funding for abortion procedures, and then abortion groups challenged it. Was that sort of the general gist of those two?
Or more broadly, the states want to be able to exclude abortion providers from their use of Medicaid funding.
Gotcha. Okay.
That issue is going to return to the court. It's exciting to see these cases coming to the court
right.
and given the opportunity for the court to uphold these laws and give greater and greater deference to the states.
Right.
And, you know, our desire is that we see the court in a series of cases over the coming couple of years cutting back on Roe versus Wade until hopefully we'll see, as I think we will, the court overturn Roe.
Okay. And so... So there, here's, I guess there was, again, I shouldn't keep referring to social media as if it's my only outlet for news and information, but certainly a lot of backlash, it seemed, against Justice Roberts a couple of times now for not seeming to move the court to take some of these abortion-related cases, particularly after the Louisiana pass. A lot of people, you know, myself included, I have to say I'm a little bit critical of him because it seems he seems to be more concerned about his legacy, you know, as the Roberts Court, what the Roberts Court did with certain, and I think that's, if I do say so myself, a fair enough criticism of him, that he does seem to be, you know, kicking the ball away when he could engage more directly. Do you have any insights on this? Because I know the court is really something that you've been very much a student of for quite a few years.
Well, there's been a lot of commentary along those lines, but also since we can't know exactly what the Chief Justice is thinking, nor the span of cases that they are looking at,
right?
And certainly the Chief Justice knows more than most Americans,
right,
about what's happening with the current justices and personnel and Justice Ginsburg's
right,
health
possibly.
Status.
Right, I know. I see a lot of the where's Ruth?
I think we need to give the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
And see what happens over the long term.
Right.
And look at all of these cases and all these abortion cases and the opportunity that the court's going to have. I mean, I was glad to see, for example, the dissent from Justice Kavanaugh, separate
yes.
dissent,
yeah.
Last Friday, Thursday night.
On the Louisiana case, yeah.
On the Louisiana, saying that the court should not have stayed the law, should allow the admitting privileges law to go into effect.
Right. And I thought he was very careful, and the phrasing of that, you know, to say this is what we're really dealing with here, is whether or not states can regulate medical procedures, you know, kind of broadening clinics within, you know, kind of taking the abortion piece out of it a little bit, to say we're dealing with sort of a broader regulatory issue here.
And on top of that, I thought, what happened on Thursday night is that the abortion providers brought this so-called emergency stay to the court. But what Justice Kavanaugh pointed out is there was no emergency.
Right.
So they were distorting the process and manipulating
Correct.
The process.
Yeah.
And I thought that was important to see
yeah.
as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I did, earlier on when we were talking a little bit about the perinatal hospice legislation, I referenced a lecture that I heard by a neonatologist at Columbia. And I just wanted to mention the name in case listeners wanted to look at this, because it would be an excellent use of your time if you want to be able to engage with people on this particular topic. It's Dr. Elvira Paravicini. So Paravicini, Paravicini, Elvira Paravicini. She is a neonatologist and assistant professor of pediatrics at Columbia University. And if you just Google her name, she talks about, again, she has cared for, I think, well over 20 years for infants who have life-limiting conditions, and she mentions how generally their deaths involve a very peaceful slipping away. Any gasping or discomfort, she says, can be alleviated with pain measures like morphine drops. Mm. And that's generally how, but she said, you know, this image that the abortion industry is trying to paint in people's mind, that your child is going to die writhing in pain, is simply not true. And, you know, and that sort of goes, whereas with many abortion procedures, your child is going to die in pain. I mean, I think that's sort of another aspect of these late-term abortions that the abortion advocates aren't facing squarely or honestly, is that, you know, you have pain receptors present at those points. I have a friend who is a pediatric anesthesiologist, and she was telling me, you know, that there's no infant neonate that I touch at 23 weeks onward that I don't give an intramuscular injection of fentanyl to. And she said, and it was very interesting. She said, you know, when I am doing these kind of surgeries, the baby's anesthesia team is actually different from the mother's anesthesia. The mother's anesthesia team worried about her. She said, my job is to take care of that baby. And so it's so interesting to see in other aspects of medicine, when we're wanting to save the baby through, you know, prenatal surgery, we're giving them pain relief. So, well, Clark, you're going to have to come back because we didn't even get to the Illinois law. But we'll know more about that hopefully within the next week or so. And then you'll be able to come back, I hope, and have
Thanks,
another
Mary.
Conversation with me. Clark, thank you so much. Everyone, the book is Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe versus Wade. You can get it on Amazon.com and go to Clark's website at AUL.org. This has been Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change. Have a great week. Goodbye and God bless you.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The